From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. This hour, we'll be joined by Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. It will be her first appearance on Connections, and we look forward to that. The senator joins us coming up at 1:30. Our connection this hour was made when an American president tried to lead the country against a largely unknown adversary. The president called people together, promised to lead all Americans, and said government would work toward defeating a new threat together. Americans responded almost uniformly, for a short while at least. 2 weeks into that crisis, the president's approval rating was 91%. This was in September of 2001, following the 9/11 attacks. And as we know, the national feeling of solidarity did not last. President Bush saw his ratings fall quickly over the next weeks and months. And yet, look at the contrast with the current pandemic 19 years later. Once again, Americans are hurting. Some are scared, dealing with the previously unknown adversary. But President Trump has not seen his approval ratings move out of the 50s, either overall or simply for his handling of the crisis. There's no national solidarity. Once again, the culture wars seem to be taking over the public discourse. Even wearing a mask can be viewed as a kind of ideological statement. As I mentioned, later this hour, we welcome Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. But first, we're joined by the author of Playing Politics with Natural Disaster. He's the chair of the Department of History and Political Science at Nazareth College, and Tim Neelan's brand new book feels very timely. How are you, sir?
Good. How are you doing, Evan?
Well, very good. So nobody told you a pandemic was coming. I mean, talk about timing for a subject like this. But why did you want to dig in and write a subject like this, Playing Politics with Natural Disaster? I mean, the full title, by the way, is Hurricane Agnes, the 1972 Election, and the Origins of FEMA. But the broader themes are there, Tim.
Right. No, exactly. So the point was that, like many people, I had the expectation that the federal government had strong support and reliability when it came to natural disasters. And as I dug deeper into it, I discovered just how much local state governments have to rely on themselves, irrespective of time or place of disaster.
I'm looking at just some of what might be parallels and some of what might be different here. So 1972, you get the hurricane and, you know, leading political figures, if they wanted to, could decide, well, we're going to try to leverage this for our advantage. And that's essentially what happened. What happened there, Tim?
Yeah, so what happened was that Richard Nixon had already had a memo in April from one of his staffers that said natural disasters have electability behind them. And so that if you show a strong support for people after a natural disaster, your electability goes up. And Nixon, of course, had barely won in 1968, and he was grasping at whatever straws he could in 1972. As you know, that's going to lead to Watergate, another disaster. But he was going to leverage the Agnes disaster to deliver what was at that time the largest relief package in U.S. history in order to try to win support in places like Pennsylvania and New York, which he had not won in 68.
And I'm looking at 2020 here, and maybe here's where the parallel breaks down. So 72, you've got a White House that is literally talking about leveraging natural disaster for political gain. And doing that with funding, doing that, who gets the money, who gets the help, at least for now. We'll talk in a moment about what happens after an election. Whereas in 2020, the allegation, at least, and I think with some merit, is that the White House has seemed a little less concerned with, or in the early days, getting PPE and ventilators to blue states. The White House has talked very directly. The president has spoken very derisively about blue states. And, you know, some of the allegation is that the purple states, the swing states, have gotten the most attention. Do you think some of that holds up? And how do you see either a parallel or a difference from 1972?
No, I think the parallel is very strong. I think Donald Trump is very concerned about his reelection. His pivot toward the economy in mid-April was in part because that was his reelection stance. He was going to run on a strong economy. Now he's trying to pivot and talk a little more about his leadership. But clearly, I mean, everything Donald Trump's doing right now is related to his reelection. So, yes, he gave generous amounts of money, what, $2.2 trillion went into the economy, partly to prop up the economy, but also to put money in individuals' hands because he does want to win support. But he is concerned now perhaps more about the economy than he is about the pandemic, because he certainly needs to have some sort of V-shaped recovery by the time November rolls around. So he's been actually agitating for opening up more quickly than some Democratic governors feel comfortable with.
The president has said in many ways during the last 10 weeks or so that states are on their own. And even Vice President Pence, who's helped coordinate the coronavirus response, has said, you know, states ought to be getting their own supply chains moving. They ought to be dealing with this on their own, and then we'll support them as appropriate, as opposed to sort of a cohesive national approach. States are on their own. What did Nixon do after the election regarding the aid for states, the aid for people in a disaster, and whether they're on their own or whether they can rely on the federal government?
No, absolutely. Richard Nixon, I mean, like the day after the election, he gave an interview where he talked about cutting back on some of the generous disaster relief he had sent into the states before the election. And he did, though, craft what would be the 1974 disaster relief legislation, which included more money for getting states to be on their own, but also to prevent disasters. So he put in money for mitigation and for prevention and training for people at the state level so that they could create their own emergency management structures. And so that was one of the benefits of Richard Nixon's new federalism, which was his philosophy of reducing the federal government's power and restoring power to the states. And so, yeah, he absolutely did. And a lot of people were dismayed. But again, I would warn people not to expect a lot of generosity from this administration once the election is over.
I guess the difference, the starkest difference I see, and this is where my history is, I'm not qualified, I'm guessing here. So you're going to tell me if I'm right or wrong. I feel like our elections now come down to five or six states. I mean, it's just this small handful of a half dozen swing states. I would assume that in the 1972s and 76s and 68s, it wasn't just five or six states determining, but I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. And the concern there that I feel, Tim, is that when you have such a small handful of states that have this much power to determine the election, just based on, you know, where the electorate is divided and where the purple is and where the red is and where the blue is, then in a natural disaster, your political leaders might be inclined to first ask, is that a purple state? Should I care more? Which is not the approach you want. Was it different in 72?
I would say it was more similar than it was different. And the reason that is remember, in 1968, there were three candidates who ran, including on the American votes. And so Nixon was that out. He won by.
So, Tim, you're flickering. Hold on, Tim. Let me just jump in for 1 second. You're flickering in and out. It's almost like you're It's almost like you're in the eye of a storm there, Tim. Flickering in and out for a second. I think we hear you okay. Let's try it again with Tim. And if we flicker in and out, what we'll do is we'll catch our breath here and kind of reestablish the connection. But go ahead, Tim.
Yeah.
We'll listen.
All right. How's the sound now?
I think it sounds pretty good. Yeah.
All right, good. I would say that, Nixon was trying to spread out the electoral map. He certainly had a southern strategy going in to 68 and then into 72. So I would say that in some ways it was very similar because Nixon, as you know, barely lost the 60 election and barely won the 68 election. So he was trying to master the political map even then.
I like the idea that there's a scapegoat in your book named Romney. I mean, does anything ever change?
No.
George Romney, scapegoat. What's the story?
Poor George Romney, you know, he was this fairly moderate governor.
Now we've dropped out entirely. Okay, hold on, Tim. Hold on right there. I've got to hear about how George Romney was the scapegoat in 72. I'm not laughing. I mean, that was a natural disaster. It was a serious situation. But, boy, you talk about dynastic politics and how everything old is new again. Tim Neeland, our guest for much of the hour, his book, Playing Politics with Natural Disaster, helps illustrate this because, of course, President Trump has been going hard for most of 2020 at Mitt Romney, George Romney's son, starting in January when Mitt Romney was the only Republican senator to vote for impeachment. And of course, now Mitt Romney last week in the Senate hearings was one of the few Republicans to push back against the administration's boasts on testing and whatnot. So the Romneys have been sort of this interesting thorn in the natural disaster side. But go ahead, Tim. Let's talk about where George Romney. You said he was kind of a moderate Republican governor in Michigan.
Right. He had he made his claim to fame by bailing out, you know, AMC, and they became Michigan governor. He was talked about being a candidate for president. He made a stumble during the primaries where he said something about people were brainwashed over the Vietnam War. That totally undercut him. So he ended up taking a position with Richard Nixon as head of HUD, a fairly new agency. And he was then responsible after the 1972 Agnes disaster with housing these people and bringing in temporary trailers and all these other things. And it was a mess. And it was a mess in part because emergency management wasn't well equipped. It certainly was kind of, there'd been a series of disasters with our emergency management programming before then, and the result was that the funds were depleted. He also had trouble with local laws. You can't just bring a trailer and prop it down anywhere. You have to get actual waivers locally and sometimes state. And so he faced a tremendous challenge of housing, you know, tens of thousands of people in a short period of time, and it did not go well. And as a result, Nixon put all the blame on him and eventually forced him to resign, and he would leave office in December of 1972. So Nixon lays the blame on him so that he can come off as the hero, and then he sent a man named Frank Carlucci down into Pennsylvania to straighten things out, his flood czar, and Carlucci came off, you know, looking like a hero. Romney comes off looking like a loser, and Nixon won that election handily with like 60% of the popular vote.
The more you read Tim Neelan's book, Playing Politics with Natural Disaster, which is about Hurricane Agnes 1972, the more it feels like a preview. You have a section on an era of corruption, and there's just one line here that I know you're talking about 72, but it feels like it could be applied. And in fact, when Senator Gillibrand's on, we're going to talk to her about some of her colleagues in the Senate who have enriched themselves. You write, quote, "While some people struggled, others enriched themselves." I mean, end quote. I think that's probably the story throughout human history in a lot of different people are opportunistic during a disaster. And I know that's nothing new. But is there any mechanism that you see in sight that's going to create a society in which whatever the next natural disaster is, that's not one of the big headlines, Tim Neelan?
Right. No, I think the problem is that the legislation has to come through people who are dependent upon how voters perceive them. And voters are really finicky. They're not particularly good at rewarding you for spending their tax dollars on mitigation and prevention, but they are very demanding that after a disaster occurs, that you get money to them as quickly as possible. And if you don't, you face election rejection come the next round of elections. So you really do have, this is infused with politics from top to bottom, even though the most local of governments where we saw corruption, but also corruption. There was a congressman who was one of the most powerful in the country, Dan Flood, who was accused of taking a bribe during the flood crisis down in Pennsylvania. Just a few thousand dollars he sold out so that some mobile home company could get a federal contract.
And once again, I'm not sure I can hear myself at all.
Oh, I can hear
I'm
you.
I'm not hearing Tim or me in the mic. All of a sudden, Tim, can you still hear me?
Yeah, I can.
What
yes,
a strange hour it's been. Thankfully, WXXI and public radio listeners are very lenient during a crisis. For a second, everything dropped out. I couldn't hear myself talking, which is an actual benefit. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Please continue.
Oh, no.
You sound better than I do, so go ahead.
No, and I just said that as you think about it, the Daniel Flood and taking a bribe during a disaster, you know, for a few measly thousands of dollars, sold to get a federal contract to a mobile home company. That's the kind of graft and corruption you have to be careful about. And we know that after every disaster, you'll find pockets of corruption, irrespective, because the desire for gain, it may be innate to human nature.
We're going to talk to Senator Gillibrand about that in part coming up when she joins us at 1:30 here on Connections. You said something that I think is really, really important as we compare natural disasters, Tim. You said that voters tend not to reward mitigation. But when there's a crisis and people are hurt and they're losing their homes or they're dying, they do expect fast action and they may reward heavy investment during the crisis. Fair enough? Yes?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely correct. So, again, it was really important that Congress and the president agree to get $2.2 trillion into the economy. And there will be another stimulus package. I guarantee that. I just don't know the outlines because they're going to have to negotiate between shielding small businesses for any employees that might get COVID-19 on the job during this crisis, and how much money to give to states, particularly Democratic governors who may want to use that money for pension plans that have been depleted by this crisis. And so that's going to be the real policy difference between Democrats and Republicans in this next stimulus package.
Sure. And the reason that that remark about mitigation stands out to me is this. Before next weekend or by next weekend, we'll hit 100,000 deaths to COVID-19 in this country already. That is with nearly 2 months of really significant mitigation efforts, of staying home, of people losing jobs in historic numbers, of people not going out in public, physical distancing. We still have 100,000 dead. And when you go back to mid-March, I remember, you know, reading as much as I could about from the epidemiologist, as I'm just kind of crash course studying this thing. And I will never forget, one said, "I dream of the day when people are saying this was all for nothing, because that will have meant that we did enough to save a lot of lives, and I'll take it. I will take their anger when they tell me you did made us all do this for nothing." Well, here we are. We're still going to have 100,000 dead in May, and people are saying this was all for nothing. People do not like mitigation. You can't prove a disaster that didn't happen, even though we're watching a disaster unfold. You can't prove, though, that 100,000 would have been 500,000 or a quarter million or a million. And just as if you have mitigation and you don't have tens of thousands of homeless after a hurricane, it's hard for people to kind of get their heads around that. And I guess I'm just remarking about how difficult that must make governing, because we want to mitigate. We want to lessen. We want to plan. We want to go jogging and eat well. We don't want to just treat for heart disease, you know? But people struggle with that, Tim.
No, I agree. I think you're right. I think, again, if it doesn't affect people directly, right, they're often reluctant to engage. And I think you hear some of these protests from people who say that, you know, wearing a mask is a political act or a political statement. They don't think that the COVID-19 is as dangerous as it is, because they have unlikely been affected by that, right? So that to them, and that's one of the reasons why you saw it. I mean, there's some rural states, some of these red states, where the number of cases is below 50,000, and the death rate is much lower. They don't see this as dangerous as people in California, Illinois, New York, Florida, Texas, places like that where there's 30,000 or more cases. And so I think part of the problem is that disasters fall unequally upon society. We're in the same storm, but we're definitely not in the same boat.
Talking to Tim Neelan, who is the author of Playing Politics with Natural Disaster. And, you know, I mentioned off the top that in 9/11, at least, you know, Americans remember those 2 weeks and, you know, the soaring approval ratings, that feeling of solidarity. And I guess I'm curious to know why you think that never really happened here, that we don't have an approval. Well, I mean, I guess there's obvious reasons, but is it troubling that we're now at a point where even with a common experience of losing loved ones or community members to COVID, of having to try to do mitigation efforts, of dealing with this threat that isn't partisan, that we don't really have kind of a shared experience that we can kind of draw on right now, that it still feels divided and kind of prone to the culture wars, Tim?
No, I think you're right. But I also think that because you had an identifiable enemy that was, you know, easy to, you know, look at and easy to understand that we were attacked. And you could compare it to other crises like Pearl Harbor. And the response was fairly unified. And, yeah, I think there was a rally around the flag in those first couple of weeks. But, again, that didn't last. I mean, there were debates about how to implement policy and, obviously, the blame game, which is, you know, going to happen in every disaster. Who should have done what, when, and how, and did we know beforehand? And we're going to see that, obviously, play out more and more in this case as we get closer to November. And certainly even after, I expect the Senate will have some investigations and certainly the House on what went wrong and what could we do to prevent this from happening again.
Is the media to blame for some of this polarization?
Well, you know, I would say that the media certainly has fueled it. I mean, they have created a kind of feeding frenzy, which comes directly from Watergate and the CNN effect, which is, you know, magnifying, you know, issues on a 24-hour cycle. But look, this partisanship goes back before 1972, right? There were debates about even having a federal disaster policy. We don't even get one until 1950. I mean, we have as a people been very reluctant to engage the government in dealing with crises unless it is, you know, clearly something like a national defense. We were attacked by X, Y, or Z. So I really think that we have a very democratic society and a very, shall we say, different kinds of Americans everywhere. You know, we're not one people, but we're one nation, and we try to deal with that on a daily basis. And so you got people even in Monroe County where it's been devastating, the COVID crisis, who think that, you know, they should protest and we should be opening sooner so that they can, you know, have their hair cut.
And you know, Tim, as you say, with President Nixon, he wins in a landslide in 1972, and then basically the next day cuts the benefits for disaster victims that he had spent the year promoting as part of his reelection campaign, and then passed legislation to push responsibility to states and localities. It feels a little bit like the 2016. Remember all that hype about the caravan that was coming to the border and how worried we should all be? I mean, after November, it's like that never happened. I don't even think I saw a single story after November. I don't think I saw a lawmaker raising that issue after November.
Right. No, that was, again, you have a means of trying to magnify issues in the public mind. And social media certainly made that a lot easier because of the way that you're able to tailor to certain communities your storyline. And people tend to feed on that. And then they share it with their friends, which has really magnified a lot of this to an extent that you couldn't even imagine in 1972.
Tim Neelan, our guest, the author of Playing Politics with Natural Disaster, Hurricane Agnes, the 1972 election, and the origins of FEMA. A worthwhile read just for the history, but gripping as you think about how it relates to the events that are playing out right now. He's also the chair of the Department of History and Political Science at Nazareth College. Let's take our only break for the hour, and we expect to be joined in just moments by Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections. Do you know a small business that's getting ready to reopen creatively? Maybe moving more of its operations outside or reaching customers in different ways. We'll talk about reopening with creativity in our first hour. In our second hour, the candidates for the New York State Senate 56th District join us. The first of our conversations with political candidates on the ballot June 23rd. We're talking to Tim Neelan, whose new book is called Playing Politics with Natural Disaster, Hurricane Agnes, the 1972 Election, and the Origins of FEMA. And we're going to be joined in a moment by Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. Also want to let you know that tomorrow night at 8 p.m., WXXI is hosting our second live forum, and that is at 8 p.m. on reopening the economy. Bob Duffy, the former lieutenant governor who has been appointed by Governor Cuomo to help lead the reopening efforts in our region, will be joining us in that program. Adam Bello, the county executive, and Michael Mendoza, Dr. Mendoza, is the Monroe County Health Commissioner. He will be there as well. We're taking questions from local business owners, and we're talking about the different phases of reopening. Tomorrow night, 8 p.m., and please, if you can, join us there on WXXI's many platforms, WXXI TV and WXXI AM 1370 and online. We're joined now by Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who's on the line with us. Senator, great to have you. Thank you for making the time. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me on.
Well, let's get right to how you see the role of Congress and the federal government. And you've written that we have the power to alleviate needless suffering, and you're keying in several areas. One of the ones you're hitting in the last 24 hours hard is SNAP. Let's start there. What do you want to see happen there?
So I've talked to our food banks around the state, and every single one of them is seeing so much more need than ever before. We've seen food banks that have lines of cars snaking through neighborhoods just to get access to food. And unfortunately, the Republican Congress has been so reluctant to allow for more food stamps. So I have a piece of legislation that hopefully will be included in the Senate version of COVID-4, which would increase the amount of benefits anyone who's accessing SNAP in terms of dollar amount, but also flexibility, because there's work requirements and all these other things that just don't apply during this epidemic. And so we want full flexibility and more generous benefits so more people can get access to food. We're also trying to change the dynamic between our farmers and our food banks to try to create a pipeline for farmers that have to dump their milk, or farmers that can't sell their produce, that those can be bought by USDA and given to the food banks. And so we're really trying to fix some of the holes in the current system so that more people can get food on their plates at night, and so less children and less seniors go to bed hungry.
Well, and at this point, Congress has allocated roughly $3 trillion in these various phases of relief. As you know, unemployment has still skyrocketed. People are hurting. And if Congress wanted to spend another $2 trillion, less than you've already spent, you could provide $1,000 a month for the next 8 months to every American adult and just say, that's it. This is what we're doing next year. $1,000 a month for every adult in the country for the next 8 months on top of the $3 trillion we've already spent. Why not just give people cash at this point? Why continue to try to earmark assistance in so many ways?
Well, if you just did the straight up $1,000 a month, for most people, that's not enough to pay their rent or their mortgage or their food bill for a month. I spend about that amount of money in food in a month. So asking Americans to survive on that is not enough, number one. Number two, not every American needs $1,000 a month. There's plenty of people who are still working who can afford their bill. There's plenty of very wealthy people who obviously can afford everything. They don't need it. So you want to have it more targeted. But I'm not against unemployment insurance. And one of the solutions that I think would be even more elegant than just $1,000 per adult is paid leave, because everybody wants to stay employed. Anybody who has a job wants to keep that job. They want to keep their health insurance that they have as part of that employment. But businesses are closed. So imagine if every worker in the country had paid leave, they could take up to 3 months off, be fully paid during that 3 months, keep their health insurance, and it wouldn't touch the business at all. That would have made a huge difference if we had it for these last few months, and you could augment it to 6 months if needed. And that would have been a better solution, because everyone could keep in their existing job and get a percentage of their income to take home every week to stay solvent and stay afloat. And that's, I think, would have been a better solution. But again, these aren't ideas that the Republicans really want to support. So hopefully we can get more movement on paid leave. We only covered 25% of workers because of the massive waivers for large businesses that the Republicans put in. And so I'm hoping that we can get all people covered for paid leave and universal sick days. I mean, 2 weeks of sick days is important, especially for our essential workers. If you're working in food supply, you're working in a grocery store, you're working in a hospital, if you're sick, you need to stay home. And if you don't have sick, you can't. And so you don't want people to have to choose between spreading the virus and harming themselves and their families and getting a paycheck. I think that's also an impossible choice.
We've heard from a number of small business owners who are really worried that, you know, in the next few months, as people who are out of work kind of run out of whatever reserve funds they have, people aren't going to be able to make rent or mortgages. We haven't seen much momentum on the national level for pausing mortgages. And I understand maybe you'd feel like you got to backstop the banks, or it would be complicated. But is there any movement to saying, hey, if we've got a bunch of people out of work for a long period of time here, we're not going to be able to have mortgage or rent payments, and we've got to have direct relief there? Is that going to happen?
I hope so. In the House passed bill, they put $75 billion aside just for housing assistance. And that money could be used for rent relief, for mortgage relief, so that people can't be evicted and kicked out of their homes. If people don't pay their mortgages, the banks could take their homes. We want the banks to absolutely not do that. We want them to create a mortgage abatement for the length of COVID. And if they need relief because that person can't afford 6 months of back mortgage or back rent, you want to be able to smooth it out over the lifetime of that mortgage so that they can just pay a little bit back every month until it's paid back, or have the federal government do greater relief and just give straight up grant relief. So I'm hoping that that provision that was put in the House can be included in the Senate.
All right. I want to talk about your colleagues in the Senate, including Senator Richard Burr, one of several members of Congress who appears to have used, at least, I don't know if this is a case of using inside information, but Senator Burr in February was making public comments about the pandemic, saying it's going to be fine. It's not a problem. The economy's fine. Privately, he's dumping stock. He's profiting. He's not the only one. You co-wrote the Stock Act, which bans members of Congress from using their access to non-public information for their own benefit. Does it apply here? Do Senators Burr and Loeffler, do they have a defense here? And can Congress do more to either penalize them or limit this kind of behavior?
Well, the last few weeks have shown exactly why I led to the passage of the Stock Act. It was a bill that Louise Slaughter originally wrote and that I then took on the Senate side. Mm-hmm. And I think the allegations as stated are deeply concerning. I'm glad that Senator Burr stepped down as the chairman of Senate Intel, and I can't think of a more egregious display of betraying public trust than the allegations here, trading on a global pandemic with non-public information. So there are things we could do to make the Stock Act even stronger. I think there's such a conflict of interest that's playing out right now that senators and House members are given non-public information and are making money off of it. We've even heard the story of President Trump's vaccine czar who had stock options for one of the coronavirus vaccine companies, and he made over $3 million. That's hugely problematic. So I would like to augment the Stock Act and perhaps consider barring members of Congress and executive branch officials from owning any securities, bonds, or derivatives while they're elected. Two, maybe consider expanding the duty portion of the Stock Act to everyone who gets intelligence briefings, meaning staff, as well as people who win elections prior to swearing in, that time when they may have non-public information. I think we need to require disclosures by firms that offer political intelligence. What they do is they come to Capitol Hill, get briefings, inside information, and then they sell it to their clients and customers. And so those things, I think, should be changed. I also have another bill called the Clean Elections Act, and that's basically getting money out of politics, really trying to end the rot and corruption at the center of Washington, which is having publicly funded elections, which I do through granting democracy dollars to every voter that they can then invest in candidates that they believe in, as opposed to candidates raising money from special interests and other people who give great deals of money.
What are the chances anything like that passes?
You know, I think if we can flip the U.S. Senate, there is a chance, because I think there is agreement amongst Democrats that money in politics is a huge problem, and that it really undermines people's faith in the system of government and faith in our democracy. And we've just watched in these negotiations of COVID packages, the special interests are spending millions of dollars lobbying Congress to make sure their industry gets bailed out first. And it's working. Look how much money was given to big businesses with some oversight, but not nearly enough. Look how much money and protection the Fed's doing for banks, just, again, keeping them solvent at all costs, and really going the extra mile to make sure they don't lose any money. Some of those changes are necessary, but you just see unfettered access, and you see that they get what they need before hardworking people get what they need.
Senator, before we go with you, and we appreciate the time, more than half the feedback from listeners leading up to today's conversation has been about your support of former Vice President Joe Biden. And I know you've stood by him. And I want to quote the feminist writer Rebecca Traister, who has been a strong voice on the national scene. Early in the reporting in the last few weeks on Tara Reid, Rebecca Traister said there was persuasive reporting that at least corroborated some of her claims, and she was taking it very seriously. Now, Traister said yesterday there has been reporting in the interim that casts more doubt on Reid's claims. But, Senator, unlike Rebecca Traister and many others, you did not seem to be persuaded early on about Reid's claims at all. Why not? Why were her claims different to you than the claims of many other women?
So, you know, I've been a very strong advocate for women to be able to have space and time to come forward with allegations for harassment, for assault. And that's really what the Me Too movement's been about. And I still feel very strongly that women have to have the right to come forward, speak their truth, and get an investigation. That has happened in this case. It's been investigated by several outlets, and that's exactly what she's entitled to as every person in the country. But I know Joe Biden well, and I've known him for a very long time. He has a record of fighting for women. He has vehemently denied these allegations, and I stand by him. And I believe that he is exactly the right person we need at this moment in time.
What you're saying about Joe Biden is what a lot of people said about Brett Kavanaugh, that he promoted a lot of women, that he has been a champion for women in the workplace, and that they knew him, that they couldn't see him doing this stuff. Isn't that the same kind of defense that Kavanaugh had?
There were multiple allegations against Brett Kavanaugh in various circumstances, not only Dr. Blasey Ford's allegations, but several from his college days. There was a similarity in the multiple allegations against him, and he had a terrible record on supporting women. And I opposed him based on his actual record, and I did not believe his statements. And so I think they're very different. Also, Brett Kavanaugh was a Supreme Court justice nominee for a lifetime appointment, and my responsibility was to vote up or down, and I voted against him on the merits of him not being qualified for that job.
All right. And finally, Joe Biden has said he just wants due process. He wants a fair shake here. But he does stand by some of the legislation and some of the changes that came from the Obama administration, particularly on college campuses, on how claims are investigated. Did any of those changes go too far in your mind?
Well, I think Betsy DeVos has been a disaster as the Secretary of Education, and she has intended since the minute she had that position to roll back protections for students on campus and to roll back Title IX protections. She has undermined the ability for anyone to get fair justice or a fair review on any college campus, and I think it's a big mistake. So I look forward to when Betsy DeVos is no longer our ed secretary.
Senator, I know there's a lot to do in Washington, and we certainly appreciate the time. I know Congress is working on the next set of packages and relief when it comes to everything from raising minimum wage to trading service for education and much more. And we hope to talk to you and your colleagues often as we deal with this crisis going forward. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you, and God bless. Everyone stay safe.
Senator Kirsten Gillibrand joining us live right here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. It's 1:45 on this Wednesday afternoon. Nice to have you along with us. And I want to turn back to our guest who's on the line with us, Tim Nealon, the chair of the Department of History and Political Science at Nazareth College. And Tim is also the author of the brand new book, Playing Politics with Natural Disaster. What do you make of what you heard there from the senator, Tim?
Yeah, no, I think the senator has a good grasp on different ways try to deal with the corruption going on. I do think this idea of mortgage relief is a strong idea because people are going to be struggling and the economy may not rebound as quickly as the Trump advocates are hoping. It may actually be flat for a while. So I think a lot of the ideas that the senator is presenting are quite good and I think could find some bipartisan support. Again, it's going to be these other policy areas. And this is compromise. I mean, there's nothing wrong with compromise and having debates. I'm not sure we all would be singing the same tune, depending on where we were at in this crisis. So, but if we could at least be in some kind of harmony, I think that would be beneficial to everyone.
The senator is talking about corruption, and as I mentioned, Tim, as we talked about your book, 1972, we saw corruption, we saw people enriching themselves in the aftermath of a natural disaster. We're seeing evidence of that now, or at least growing evidence. And Senator Gillibrand led in 2011 the passage of the Stock Act. Congresswoman Louise Slaughter wrote the STOCK Act. I mean, does that go far enough? She talked about there, about even going further and saying she doesn't think people in Congress should own stocks. I mean, she's very concerned about what that can lead people with power to do. Did any of this go far enough?
I think the problem is how that would actually look in terms of the rights of these individuals to have, you know, stock for their own retirement or benefit. How would you implement that, and would it really be as effective as you think? I just wonder about the details of it, but I think it's a great idea. I also think there should be more stringent penalties for people who abuse their office, and those penalties should not just come from outside of the House or the Senate. I think they should be on this more effectively and censoring their colleagues. And, you know, in some egregious cases, why not remove them, right? Expel them from the body. They certainly have that power.
They do have the power, but it seems to rarely act upon it. And I guess I understand why. I mean, you don't necessarily want a precedent that your colleagues are going to toss you out, especially when you can sort of put the patina of partisanship on it. And I guess I do understand that. But this, to me, seems a little bit more blatant. I mean, Senator Burr, if you heard Senator Gillibrand there talking about Senator Burr, he resigned his chairmanship of a Senate committee. He did not step down as a senator. The allegation is that Senator Burr in late February, this is not an allegation, in late February he was telling people publicly, we're going to be fine. The American economy is going to be fine. People are, you know, we're going to hang in there. This virus is not going to be a problem. And then in a much smaller, more private setting, he was telling people that same week, this thing looks a lot more like 1918 than anything else to me. This looks like a real pandemic that could kill a lot of people, that could do massive damage, could do damage to the economy. And that week he just happened to be dumping stock and looking like he was getting out of certain areas that would be more vulnerable. Meanwhile, Senator Kelly Loeffler of Georgia, who already has more money than everyone I know put together, was still doing the same thing. She was putting out videos saying that America's strong, tough, this thing's not a problem, and she was dumping stock, and she was investing. The one stock she was buying was in work-from-home software before anybody was out of work. I mean, I don't buy that it's a coincidence here. So I guess what I'm asking here, Tim, is this a moment where Congress could get tough and maybe expel one of their members? Historically, it doesn't seem to happen very much. I mean, how far do you have to go before that kind of happens?
I really think, though, if Congress would make an example of some of its members, who, again, particularly during a crisis like this, I mean, yes, what Chris Collins did was very shady, was, you know, not necessarily in a crisis. But, you know, when you're using a disaster to individually, you know, benefit yourself and at the same time as giving misinformation, I think that's a moment when, you know, Congress really should, as a body, you know, hold up the ethics and integrity. And again, you know, it'll be up to the voters. The voters could always reelect these people anyway. But I just think that, you know, those are some rare cases. But boy, if you made an exception, I think people would think twice about trading on inside information in the future. And you had mentioned before, you know, enrichment. I mean, we have a term called disaster capitalism, where people benefit from these crises. These tend to be corporations and other, you know, larger entities, not individual corruption. But yeah, you know, we have to keep an eye on that as well. I mean, who is going to benefit from this disaster in terms of, you know, some of the relief payments? And I think that needs to be investigated. We need to keep that in mind as well.
Tim, I knew that if I ask about Tara Reid and the allegations against Joe Biden, some listeners are inherently upset with me. I mean, we had a conversation on this program with some of the leaders in our own community, including the leaders from Resolve and Willow, and they take allegations seriously when those allegations come up. They're not saying don't vet them, but they're saying we should take them seriously and we should investigate them seriously. And the reason that I wanted to bring it up with Senator Gillibrand is she dismissed Tara Reid's allegations before there was much investigation. She says that's because she knows Joe Biden and she knows his character, and that's why she didn't believe them. That is the response that many people gave regarding Brett Kavanaugh. Well, I've known him for years. He's a great guy. He's hired more women and promoted them in the workplace, and he is a champion for women in the workplace. I can't see this happening. In my mind, that is a thin defense. I'm not saying it's not relevant. I think character is relevant. I think it does matter. I think if you or I or anybody were accused, you would want people to stand up and say, hey, this is a good guy. He's been good to people. I think that matters. But I don't know that it is fully the only thing that matters if you're going to conclude that a claim is invalid, I guess. I was surprised to hear that was enough for Senator Gillibrand to say that claim is invalid after everything she has said for years about the importance of believing women. Was it a fair question? Was I out of bounds?
No, I think it's a fair question, and I think people on the left and obviously the right are asking this, and feminists are asking this question as well. I think it needed to be asked and answered. Certainly, you may not be, you know, fully happy with the senator's response, but the question has to be asked, because the senator was one of the first people to come out against a member of her own political party and who was accused of some behavior that was unacceptable. And so I think that she's got a track record of being bipartisan on that. But this is a presidential candidate, and they really don't have anyone else right now. So I think that, you know, one has to be that you'll see Democrats being maybe a little more circumspect about this kind of hot button issue.
Yeah. And before anyone sends me an email sort of accusing me of bias, I promise you on this one. I mean, my goal as a journalist is just to take claims seriously and to honor the commitment to investigate. And I think that should be done in Tara Reid's case. I think it maybe took a little while to get that going. It is happening. It's important. People will make their own decisions about whether the claims look to be holding enough water to be corroborated. I mean, there's not going to be visual evidence. This is one of the hardest things to adjudicate. It's very, very difficult, and I acknowledge that. But I don't think the question is out of bounds. I think Senator Gillibrand has been such a strong voice on this, and Tim is right. What she said about Al Franken helped sink Al Franken's career. I get emails probably once a week from listeners who are still angry about that. If I had more time with Senator Gillibrand, I would have tried to explore that more. It's not easy. It's the first appearance I have she's ever made on this program, and we respect her, and we respect her time. We know she's busy. But you've got 15 minutes only, and I would love to explore that at length. Frankly, I would love to know if she thinks the Me Too movement is going in the direction that she wants it to go, and because, you know, there's always going to be bumps in the road. I'd be fascinated by that, to hear from Senator Gillibrand. So perhaps in a future conversation there. But I will say, Tim, you know, you talk to plenty of people on all sides, political parties. The Democratic Party remains kind of split and sore about that, I would say. Is that fair, too?
No, that is absolutely a fair assessment. And I think it's, you know, this is an issue, like you say. I would say that you have to give the person that comes forward the respect, and you need to listen to them, and you need, as you say, vet the claims, irrespective of who it's aimed at. Because, you know, for too many years, victims were told to be silent, or they were silenced. Yeah. And that is one of the reasons we needed a Me Too movement to come along and to start, you know, shining light on, you know, people like Harvey Weinstein and members of Congress, and certainly business individuals. So, no, I think that was a fair question, and it was to stand up for Tara, I think, is the right thing to do.
And let me also say that I couldn't agree with Tim Nealon more. The movement was way long overdue. We have an embarrassing history of allowing harassment and discrimination, mostly against women, not always, mostly. And that is far from over. And I totally understand that. I also understand how difficult it can be when a claim like this comes out And someone like Senator Gillibrand feels like she knows a guy like Joe Biden and has known him for his whole career. And then you get this allegation and you say, this doesn't sound like the person that I know. It's tough. I understand that. So I hope, listeners, we ask questions that were fair but direct. And that's what our job is to do. Tim, final thoughts from you. What should we be looking for to make sure that those in political power are operating fairly to actually help people and not just either enrich themselves or to protect their political circumstances?
Well, again, I think you're going to need the public to be, you know, rational and reasonable, and they're going to have to really, you know, read newspapers and go to places like WXXI, public broadcasting. They're going to ask those tough questions and have people from both sides sit down and talk about it, because otherwise, you know, in the midst of a crisis, like you say, you can pass legislation that will benefit some. It may benefit many, but not to the same extent that it will enrich others. And we certainly don't want to waste our time. Oh, there's the music.
You nailed it, my friend. Tim, thank you. Congratulations on the book. It's called Playing Politics with Natural Disaster, Hurricane Agnes and the 1972 Election, and the Origins of FEMA. Tim Neelan's new book about 1972, but it is timeless, and you'll hear the echoes today. Talk to you again soon, Tim. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And our thanks to Senator Kirsten Gillibrand and her time and her office for helping make that work. Our thanks as well to the entire team at Connections. Rob Braden is the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. It's beautiful. And with Connections finally ended, you now have the green light to go outside and enjoy it. I hope you do, and we'll talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.